Hello, Ann Arbor and the world. This is It's Hot in Here, and this is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. And we have a hot show for you today. Across from me is Andrea Krause. Hello, Andrea.
Hello, Ann Arbor and the world. So glad to be with you again on this lovely Friday.
Yes, and diagonally across, we have Rebecca Harden.
Once Hello. Again in the studio, and guess
We're
what?
So happy for
it's
that.
Hot in here.
So hot.
It feels darn right tropical outside. I can't lie. Once it gets above 30, even 27, 25 even.
People are walking around town just smiling, opening their arms up with their coats open.
I unzipped my jacket the way here as an experiment.
Feels good.
And we're also here with Pete Larson.
That would be Dr. Pete Larson.
Dr. Pete Larson, forgive me.
Hello, y'all. How are you doing?
Pete Larson, who is a PhD in epidemiology, does field research on disease ecology, interspecies disease transmission, malaria, and other exciting virulent pathogens in Africa. Perhaps as importantly, he's a heavy metal musician, so we're going to start out today with a track from Pete. Am I right?
You're definitely right.
We're going to listen to a track called Turn Up the Music off of one of his early 2000s album, which Pete wrote, and I think you produced it, right, Pete? And
That's
on
great.
Your own record
yep.
label, Bulb Records. So let's give a listen to Turn Up the Music from Dr. Pete Larson.
Hey.
The music's up. CBN FM 88.3 Ann Arbor and the world. This is It's Hot in Here, and we have a fantastic show for you today, not only with the maker of that music, Dr. Pete Larson, otherwise known as one of the two-person band 25 Swabs. We've also got a call-in coming up, Andrea.
That's right. In the second half of the show, we'll be hearing from Katie Hearn and Emily Bunder from Detroit's Heidelberg Project about the fantastic work they're doing there, revitalizing communities through art.
Fantastic. So we've got a little bit of Africa, a little bit of Detroit, and some fantastic music going up. I want to turn to our guest, Pete Larson, and I want to just ask him to tell us a little bit about his band and what we just heard in that music. That's you and drummer Fumi Kawasaki.
Yeah, I had a band for years and years. I've been playing music since, I don't know, you know, when I was 13. I had a record label from 92 to 2008. And it was just me and Fumie, and we drove around the country and we played this crazy rock music and didn't do anything else for a long time. And it was really quite wonderful.
This was before, if I'm correct, you got into quite a few different layers of a Michigan education, right? You have a lot of degrees from the University of Michigan. Tell us about that.
I have 3 degrees from the University of Michigan. I can't go anywhere else. No one else will take me, I guess.
No. We're not letting you go. No, we're not letting you go.
Branded.
Yeah, I got a PhD in epidemiology recently, which was incredible, through the School of Public Health.
And that work was on malaria, right?
Mostly malaria. Yeah, malaria in Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi.
We'll be coming back to that later in the show. Okay. Stay tuned, folks. What else? What other degrees?
I have a degree in biostatistics from the School of Public Health, degree in math from Eastern Michigan University, and inexplicably, I have a degree in German literature from University of Michigan.
So what inspired this transition from traveling musician and producer and recorder of your awesome things and having your own record label to all of these multiple degrees and cutting edge research?
Money.
I've never heard anyone say they're gonna do doctor or go to graduate school.
Did we have a next question for that?
We can all go home now.
Yeah, because really, let's be honest, preventing infectious disease in the most impoverished rural areas never gonna
pay amazingly
well. Cow.
It is, yeah. Just rolling
it's
in.
It's like,
but,
you're rolling,
you know,
in.
Yeah. Compared to life on the road as a rock musician, it's not bad.
Well, and
yeah.
They do say, you know, music and math, right? Brains.
That's true.
Is it what do you think about that, Pete? Is it do you have one of those brains that's like a music and math and German lit? Okay, never mind. Let's bracket the German lit. But is it a music and math mind out there? What's the?
I don't know. I can't really comment on that. I have no idea. You know.
But you love statistics. I've seen online. Mm. Okay, Pete's got a blog. Okay. We're going to link to that.
PeterLarson.com.
I've seen you publish stuff on. You've done statistical analyses of metal music markets and production. I mean, like you've used the statistics to even analyze the metal music scene.
A guy's got to give back, you know. You got to go out in the world and you get these skills and you bring them back to what you love, you know.
But you love the math.
I do love the math and I love the metal. Yeah, both. Yeah.
Very, we definitely need more of it. Somebody was sitting around the CBN studios earlier this morning and they were like, oh, you've got Pete Larson on today. He's that perfect combination of like malaria prevention and like, you know, black metal, death rock metal. The world needs more of that, was the direct quote.
I agree. Yeah. We definitely need more people in metal in public health, that's for sure.
It's fantastic.
cutting edge intersection.
We're gonna talk with you today about the cutting edge of your most recent postdoctoral work on animals and humans and disease. We're gonna talk to you about your published work on malaria and then we're gonna do a little conversation about the metal scene on the African continent as you're in it and learning from it. And so we've got a really fantastic hour coming up. But just, you know, before we get into really all those details, give us a little more background on your band is called 25 Suaves, and we're playing some early tunes from you guys. Now, you said you and Fumie, you were both playing in a bigger band?
No, we played in this band.
Okay.
That was the band.
Okay.
It was the 3 of us. I lived in Japan in the late 90s, and I had a band with a friend of mine from North Carolina. And Fumie became the drummer, and eventually we kicked the other guy out and went out on our own and went back to the States and started playing full time.
Got married and
then happily ever after.
Started making fantastic peach cobblers. That's neither here nor there, but Fumie is quite a cook,
that's
I will
true.
Say that.
That is true.
You guys eat better than anybody I know. So listen, what about the whole question of how you got into metal in the first place? You said you were 13 when you started messing around,
you know,
music. What are you doing?
When you're a kid in the 1980s, you know, in Mississippi, then you don't have a whole lot of other things to do. And
okay,
you know,
wait, besides heavy metal in Mississippi in the 80s?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who around you was into the metal scene in Mississippi in the 80s? I mean, I
all 3 of us. Me and 2 other guys.
And you don't,
it seems a very tight-knit.
Yeah,
group.
It seems a tight-knit. Yeah, yeah. We're still close.
Baby. Yeah. Yeah, you don't need a symphony orchestra.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you hear about a metal show and, you know, you drive 8 hours to go to it, you know, because Atlanta's the closest city. And,
oh, my gosh.
You know, it's, of course, fantastic.
But you fell in love with it somehow. You, like, got into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love the metal.
And grew up with it, basically.
Totally.
I mean, you're still into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
It's loud. It's fun. It's powerful, and the people are amazing, and the music's amazing, and everything about it is amazing. Mm-hmm. And you know, wherever you go, all over the world, you know, there's metal, you know, in most places at least. And wherever you go, there's a sort of common language out there that you can speak, you know, and people.
Haven't thought about metal as the international language of kind of, you know, transcultural diplomacy before.
It's true. There's deep networks of metal fans out there that, you know, communicate all with each other and, you know, trade music and talk about music. And, you know, it's kind of an international brotherhood and sisterhood of.
Wow, my mind's going to, like, iron smithing and smelting.
Well, I have
as, like, ancient technologies that also did similar.
But I mean, I was
in
Northern Europe last summer, and
that's the home of metal.
Oh my goodness! And I guess
per capita.
But isn't there kind of like a little bit of like a kind of like Teutonic, like Aryan thing that goes on with metal? That, like, I mean, can
have you been to Southeast Asia?
No.
You know, metal all over the place. Latin America, metal all over the place. And you know, now, more recently, you know, it's coming to Africa, which is really incredibly encouraging.
Well, that is cool. Well,
and actually, like, you know, when you, even in the United States, when you look at it, the history of metal, you know, a lot of the, like, the greatest and most influential bands were actually African American.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, so they get written out of popular understandings of
they
metal,
do.
Just like they get written out of popular understandings of environmentalism sometimes.
True. Absolutely.
Hmm. Who knew?
Hmm.
That's
absolutely
ridiculous.
Yeah. You know, like the Bad Brains from Washington, D.C., you know, were like the, you know, the, like, fathers of punk and metal. And that was, like, you know, way early on. And they were just, like, you know, three dudes in art school in Baltimore.
Well, it's
know?
So funny because the dominant narrative is like, oh, well, there's Jimi Hendrix. There's the outlier, you know, like there's this one.
But I mean, that's where the music comes from.
Uh-huh.
You know, those are the, like, you know, the trailblazers.
Well, let's hear some more of your music. You've got a song coming up. It's called 1938. I don't know what that's about, but this is another one off of your early recording.
Actually. I have no idea.
You just called it that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is another early recording of yours, early 2000s on your record label.
Mm.
Well, let's listen.
Okay.
All right. We'll be right back.
we're back. That was 1938 by Pete Larson. I mean, by the number of swans.
25 swans. 25. Wow. Although when you look at their videos, it's clear that really there's two of them that are as big as 25 or more.
We fired the other 23.
So. No, you guys fill it up, though. You fill up a stage, you and Fumi. Fantastic. Pete Larson here with us today. Dr. Pete Larson, epidemiologist. And I want to just take a moment to talk a little about epidemiology, because we've been focusing on the metal part of Pete Larson. Let's talk about your malaria work for a minute. I'm really curious to hear what you were doing. You were working out in Kenya, actually a region not too far from where our host and founder Jennifer Johnson works.
You're in
Kisumu, right?
You
were in Lake Victoria. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In Tanzania, Kenya.
Primarily in Uganda, but I've done work in all three.
Okay.
She did amazing work in Kenya with these women.
Yeah.
On these islands, right? Didn't you go to some really interesting fisheries in Kenya when you
were... Fangano Island.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah. Well, we should
just... Small world. Wait, is there a metal band in Fangano Island?
There's no power on Mfangano, so...
Right. Yeah. It would be hard. I wonder if you can make metal without electricity.
I
seriously thought of Pete during the State of Union address, when really the only thing President Obama said about Africa was that we're working, and I quote, with corporations to address the energy needs of rural Africans for development. And I was like, more metal.
More metal.
Yes.
But seriously, what about malaria?
There's a lot of metal allusions.
Metal is the biggest symbol of development. Once your country has a metal scene, you're in.
You heard it from Pete Larson.
Yeah.
Can you correlate like malaria rates and metal? Like, does metal, malaria decline?
More
as metal?
Metal, less malaria.
Hmm.
You know, so
that
I'm recommending
like a science or a nature paper coming out.
I think so. Yeah.
I think so. Well, you've done.
When you look country by country across the globe, you know, the countries with more metal have almost no malaria.
So that's the answer. Let's get more metal out there.
Exactly.
So you're a crusader.
Exactly what
you're
I'm
a crusader.
Advocating for. Yeah.
No, but really, you do work on spatial issues in malaria.
Yeah,
you're on that kind of cutting edge that we over in the Environment and Natural Resources School see a lot of how to understand the relationship between physical space, geography. Some of your work's been on distance to medical care and racing.
Yeah, I mostly work on, I do a lot of work with spatial things, looking at distance to health services, to transportation infrastructure, to economic centers, and look at their associations with malaria prevalence. And I do that in Kenya and Malawi.
What have you found? Any counter?
People who live far away from stuff tend to do poorly.
So
access to health services, prompt and efficient health services, is obviously incredibly important. And the farther away a clinic is, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, where people have to walk, the more of a barrier that becomes.
Or take a boat. I mean, I've been in landing sites and a boat lands with someone who they were coming for treatment and then they're deceased. So by the time they get to the shore, then they have to turn back for the burial.
Exactly.
I mean, it's devastating.
It's horrible.
Is that both because of treatment and like prophylaxis sort of prevention issues, or are people being infected in remote areas more so than
it's everything? It's everything. So, I mean, you know, people who live far away from healthcare and from economic centers and from transportation infrastructure tend to live at the highest risk for malaria. And that was true in the United States, for example. You know, when we looked at Mississippi and the Mississippi Delta, you know, there was a reason that malaria held out in those areas, is because it was far away from stuff. And when people started, you know, moving into cities and becoming more urbanized, and actually when we started reaching out, things started going down.
But also it was like very wet and
people tend to not build cities in swamps. You know,
except for New Orleans,
where, you know, there was like
Which
this high
like
poverty
the
and
city
high malaria.
That never stops surprising us.
And it's amazing
that
place.
It even exists.
But it's incredible.
But, you know, I never thought of that.
And like there's metal.
The connection. New Orleans metal?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. Some wonderful metal down there, yeah.
It's not all Papa John. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, I didn't think about the malarial kind of Mississippi to the malarial Malawi kind of connection in your life before, but that's interesting. Like,
it's like home over there.
Okay.
I mean, no joke. No,
it's true.
Yeah, when I went to Malawi, I was just like, did I get on the wrong plane? Like, what's this about? You know, and it was, you know, in a good way.
I hear that. I mean,
it's like
you
all
know.
The good parts of Mississippi, like without all the, you know, the not so good parts.
Well, yeah. Okay. True confessions. You know, Pete and I collaborate on a project in Kenya. And one of the reasons it's been a pleasure working
with
you
Southerners.
Is because you're, that's true.
Yeah.
So you get, you know, the whole thing of like stopping to ask people like, how's your mom's back doing? Is you know, and what happened with that little girl that was saved? But you don't even start asking a survey question about healthcare access until you first have figured out how everybody's doing, had a cup of tea, you know, taking your time with people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you enjoyed the field work then. You
I
were
love
out
field
there.
Work. Yeah.
You and Jennifer. We got two of a kind in the studio today. And it's hot in here. Oh, my goodness. That's awesome. So, but what about, so the urban thing, you were talking about the urban connection and some of the issues around, like, urbanicity is a paper you worked on with Joe Eisenberg over at the Public Health School.
Yeah. When you look, you know, at the landscape, you know, it's difficult to determine exactly. I mean, we think of urban and rural as being very obvious things. You know, like, you know, it's like
in Michigan, we
like
do
porn, you know, when you see it. Right.
Right.
But, you know, in reality, when you look at it, you know, when you go to like the middle of the Yukon, for example, I mean, there's town centers up there and they have like urban like places, you know, mm-hmm. they have like a health facility. Mm-hmm. They have like, you know, economic infrastructure. They have power, all these things. And even when you go in the city, I mean, think about New York City, think about Central Park. You know, that's kind of a rural space within an urban area. And in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, you see in the middle of the cities like Nairobi, for example, and people be growing crops.
Yeah.
You know, they'll be doing like have livestock, you know, there'll be chickens and goats.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be all these things that are just like urban spaces.
Right.
Or it's a rural spaces. And so, like, you know, when we talk about malaria, we know that malaria is lower in urban places, but it's not zero. And mm-hmm. so what we're thinking is, you know, there's like, you know, places within cities that are perhaps like somewhat conducive to malaria transmission. And the question was like, what exactly are those things are? Mm-hmm. And can we look at a gradient of urbanicity rather than just a hard cutoff? And when we look at that gradient, we're asking like what goes into creating that relationship.
Are you able to look at also kind of mobility of people? I'd hear a lot in Uganda that those going up country, maybe they'd come back with malaria and then you can spread it to your neighbors when mosquito bites you, bite someone else.
Huge issue in sub-Saharan Africa where people are extremely mobile, you mm-hmm. know, and you know, when we talk about, you know, urban cases of malaria, you know, the question is are they getting infected within the cities or mm-hmm. are they getting infected when they go back home?
Mm-hmm. And that's true for both malaria and other diseases like mm-hmm. HIV. A lot of the work that's been done on the HIV stuff with economic frontiers and mining, a lot of that work's come out of South Africa and Botswana, actually home to the
amazing
band
metal
that we
scene.
Are going to hear mm-hmm. from next,
yes.
right? So this is Mass. This is Crack Dust by Mass for the Deads by Crack Dust.
Yes. I've heard a lot about Botswana, but not that they have an
amazing metal scene.
So I'm very
They're
excited.
The pioneers.
Tell us about this band.
Sub-Saharan African metal. They're part of the scene of Botswana metal dudes that. A lot of them like do like bunny farming and livestock.
Oh my gosh, we pulled up images of these guys in the studio
so
earlier.
Amazing.
We're gonna post this blog. You guys will not believe the style of these metal guys out of Botswana. Let's listen.
Okay. Of the slap of war, faster than life, the business of the better life. Works, not the great, but the greatest. War, for first of God. Work, for the public to decide. Shut up, blood, of God, do not see the combat. For our side, when the fire's when the bullets crossing the bus, senses to know. We can beat it, we got our end and never stop, profit from the day. What's up to business is the last bullet day. Force of our day parties, roll for the bullets and the side. Love is good, love is bad. Just because of this.
WCBN FM Ann Arbor 88.3 on your FM dial. That was a track from a Botswana-based heavy metal band, Crack Dust, Mass for the Dead. And we are here in the studio with Dr. Pete Larson, an epidemiologist, talking to us about music and malaria in African landscapes. So we had a couple questions for you on the malaria work. You were talking about how hard it is for people who are far away from clinics and hospitals to get treatment and to survive malaria, in fact. I don't know. Andrea was wondering stuff about that.
Yeah, I saw something on your profile on the WDI website on how you're interested in developing ways to encourage the use of malaria interventions in the home. So I guess that makes sense. If people are far away, what can we do to get treatment or prevention actually out to those remote places? Can you talk about your work with that?
That's obviously a huge challenge. So, you know, in developing countries, you know, health facilities are set up, but they're not necessarily set up to optimally deliver health care to everyone equitably. And in sub-Saharan Africa, I mean, you have people live everywhere, you know, and sometimes you see people live like 20, 30 kilometers away from the nearest health facility, and that's a long way. Mm-hmm. So if you can move as much of that care as possible to either the community or the home, you know, then you might avert, you know, the worst disease outcomes. Because a lot of times what we find is that people will wait. You know, just like I do, for example, you know, I won't go to the hospital or the clinic, you know, until I think it's really, really bad. You know, and if you have to walk 20 kilometers, you're going to wait even longer.
So when you talk about bringing that closer to the home, is that through community health workers or through infrastructure?
Exactly. Okay. So mostly through community health workers is like, you know, that's about the most effective way. You know, you train somebody up to treat, you know, give basic, you know, simple health care, treat malaria, treat, you know, basic diarrheal disease, you know, like give vaccinations, all these really simple things. And, you know, you can hire somebody from the community, supply them, give them enough to work with, and then they can deal with like the most immediate concerns. You know, obviously there's limits to that. You know, if a kid, you know, gets like cerebral malaria, for example, then they'll have to travel.
And that's a really scary thing to see. But you're also working more recently now on some other pathogens, right? Like your postdoctoral research with us, that building these bridges between the school of environment, the school of public health, ecology, that's a whole different set of issues, right? You're looking at Q fever and brucellosis. Those are
nasty bacterial diseases.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And they don't just affect people in households.
They affect animals as well.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, like people who depend on livestock, you know, which is a lot of Africans, most rural African homes have some sort of livestock, goats, cows, pigs, you know, chickens, donkeys, whatever. For people who depend on livestock, they have intimate contact all the time with their animals, maximal, you know, and they're sleeping next to them inside these enclosures. And so they're at high risk for...
So what does that field work look like? What do you do for that kind of research? Like, how do you do that work?
So we went out this summer to Kenya, which Rebecca is obviously involved in, and went to some Maasai communities out in northern Kenya and started taking blood from livestock. And we're going to test that and see if the animals have this pathogen in their blood or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then long term, we hope to go to humans and take blood from humans and sort of see how, you know, what are the possible transmission pathways between animals and humans? And are there specific herd management techniques that can perhaps minimize the chance of infection in humans? Because these diseases have implications for reproductive health. They're associated with miscarriages, for example, both in animals and humans. And obviously in humans, it's a serious issue. You know, we lose babies. And in animals, it becomes a serious economic issue for the herders because they're losing part of their...
So you're really developing a gender component as well to your research then. And I think of that partly because I know the next track you lined up for us on this show today is a female-fronted heavy thrash metal band from Madagascar.
I love this.
I mean, okay, well, this is Sasa Maso.
Yes. Yes. They're a four-piece out of Madagascar. I think they were active like in the early 2000s. Madagascar, like I never knew this, you know, for a long time, has a really quite well-developed metal scene. It's isolated, being an island, but they're definitely kicking it down there.
And the girls are kicking it. Let's listen for a minute.
Oh,
Heating up a cold day in Ann Arbor, WCBN FM 88.3. It's the environmental talk and music show. It's hot in here, and it was hot to hear Sasamaso, the female-fronted heavy thrash metal band from Madagascar, on that last track.
No one saw that coming.
Who'd have thunk, right?
Who'd have thunk?
Exactly.
And I got to say, looking at your blog and the blogs you gave us today, Pete Larson, you showed us some amazing images of both guys and girls in full metal gear.
I bet per capita, like women, there's probably a higher percentage of women in African metal than probably any other metal scene around the world, except maybe Japan.
You know, that's interesting. I mean, I wonder how you explain that. Well, you've done some real work. You talked earlier about a metal map that you've made when you're looking, or you've seen where you distribute, like you can see the distribution per capita
of metal bands. Yeah.
Worldwide.
Yeah. And obviously in Scandinavia, comes out way on top.
Sure.
Few people because it's so cold, and lots of metal bands because it's so cold and there's nothing else to do.
Right.
Dark, bleak landscapes,
A lot of seething anger.
Exactly.
I think.
Fantastic.
And power. And power.
And energy.
Dependable electricity.
Right. Electrical energy. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And strong social welfare programs to keep, poor metal musicians fed. So.
Which is important. We could do
Absolutely.
Better with that. We could
yes.
do better with that
we
right here.
We need state subsidies for metal.
Yeah. I'm going to bear that in mind.
Okay.
We do a lot of policy discussions on this station, so we'll be sure to make
that. We've already
that.
Determined that malaria, it can prevent, or metal can prevent malaria, right?
Which is key. And who's really thinking in those ways?
The metal malaria nexus.
Except for Dr. Pete Larson from University of Michigan. And so your mix, you have this mix of, you're talking about your field research on bacterial pathogens like brucellosis and Q fever, where you're actually, out there restraining camels and drawing blood samples
and getting brucellosis, right?
You got brucellosis.
I love it.
Oh my gosh.
What do you love about it?
Well, brucellosis?
Yeah.
Besides the rifampin?
The drugs? Come on now. I don't think very many metal musicians are making a reputation on that drug.
Talk about participant observation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, nothing like it. Brucella is really, really quite fantastic.
Flu-like.
Until, as long as you know what you have.
What are the symptoms?
Fever, malaise, feeling bad, feeling awful, intense depression is one, which was quite fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it'll never come back, but
Well, that could easily get misidentified as a malarial thing if you were in a rural African setting without the lab techniques to accurately identify, right? So this is where your two projects kind of start to overlap.
And that's the trouble with these febrile diseases. It's really hard for developing country health systems who lack diagnostic facilities to really isolate what this could possibly be. And so they'll just treat it for malaria because that's what they know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that you're managing to straddle these worlds of building capacity for that kind of diagnostic work and for rural education and networking, social networking on these issues, at the same time that you're also able to sort of keep track of the heavy metal scene in these African countries where you're working.
Which is fabulous. Right. You know, metal is like the number one indicator of development. You know, if your country has a metal scene, you've made it.
I love it. I totally love it.
Botswana, you know, Botswana is one of the fastest growing economies in all of sub-Saharan Africa and has been that way since the 60s. Obviously, South Africa had the most developed metal scene because it's South Africa, the most developed country, then Botswana. Then Mozambique came online. Angola's online now. Now Kenya. You know, as of what anybody can tell about 2001, they've got a really quite vibrant metal scene going on. And it's, you know, they're singing in Swahili and they're sort of like weaving in these sort of like African influences into their music and,
cool.
and singing about like, you know, corrupt politicians and, you know.
Well, you know, sitting here, all of us, 30 minutes from Detroit, right, from D-Town, we all understand about those mixes of music and the mishmash of development gone wrong and gone right. In fact, we're about to take really shortly a call from folks working on those issues mm-hmm. in Detroit. And, mm-hmm. and Pete, you've selected a tune for us to listen to sort of transition to that. I wanted to also dip into our archive for a minute.
Yes.
And remind ourselves that this talk show has done work on Detroit, on the mix of art, music, and kind of making these community spaces like you're talking about where you can have a vibrant scene even when the development thing is sort of tenuous, right? So let's dip in and listen to Beth Diamond for a minute, who talked on the mic for this show a couple years ago mm-hmm. about that kind of work.
Yes. She's talking earth art, I believe.
Earth art.
Anyway, enough about me. We've got a great guest here today, Beth Diamond, as we already announced. For those of you just tuning in, Beth Diamond is a professor here at the University of Michigan in the School of Natural Resources and Environment. And I first met Beth way back in, it must have been 2007, way back in the day.
4 years ago.
When I was an undergrad here and I took a course that was looking at the history behind landscapes. It was called Nature, Culture, and Landscape. And it literally changed my life. It did. It helped me become a landscape architect today while studying to be a landscape architect. But in that course, Beth really did a great job of kind of giving an overview of landscapes and landscape history, but also introduced me to this idea of earth art, which I had never heard about before. And it's something that I think more people need to be in tune with. So, Beth, why don't you explain to Gina and the rest of the folks out there, what is earth art?
What is earth art? Well, earth art is art that reveals or unveils or uncovers aspects of the physical environment that you wouldn't normally be aware of otherwise. It's not simply about putting art outdoors or sticking a sculpture in a public space. It's more about incorporating the physical environment into the work of art itself, making the environment a work of art.
So it's not just mud pies in my backyard?
Well, it could be that too. Why not?
Awesome.
But you're not sticking the Monet, you know, by a lake.
That was our WCBN host, Kat Superfisky, now in California, and scholar and activist Beth Diamond. Rest in peace, Beth, no longer with us, but did beautiful work with the Heidelberg Project in Detroit and has helped us get layered stories about art and music and identity and urbanicity, a term from Dr. Pete Larson. Let's listen for just a few seconds to a tune called Etched on My Heart.
Etched on My Heart.
And this is a band?
Parking Lot Grass.
Out of Kenya.
Out of Kenya, yeah.
Let's listen to just a little bit, and then we're going to talk with a couple of folks working in the Heidelberg situation in Detroit about an update from there. That was Parking Lot Grass out of Kenya. And we're back.
That's right. We're back and bringing it home to Detroit. We are on the phone. We have Katie and Emily from the Heidelberg Project, which is art, energy, and community. It's an open-air art environment in the heart of an urban community on Detroit's east side. Katie and Emily, are you with us?
We are.
We are. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having us.
So Katie is the Marketing and Communications Coordinator at the Heidelberg Project, and Emily is the Special Projects Coordinator. Katie, Emily, could you guys just give a brief overview of, I know that the Heidelberg Project is so many things, but to the listeners that may not be familiar with it, what is it? What do you guys do?
Sure. Well, we are best known for our funky two-block outdoor art environment on Detroit's east side. Tyree Guyton actually founded the art environment on the street where he grew up. But at the same time, we are also a 501c3. We're a community arts nonprofit, and we have our primary focuses in youth education, but also kind of community development, and by default, we are also a tourist attraction, one of the top three in the city of Detroit, actually.
Wow. That is not surprising to me. Looking at the Heidelberg Project's website at the moment, there have been some real energetic redesigns that show people coming into that neighborhood and moving through those spaces in a way that I think is really upbeat and optimistic and interesting, too.
Absolutely.
Yes, definitely. We're lucky in that we actually get to meet people from all over the world, even on, say, a Wednesday afternoon. So it's really interesting to see all the different types of people that do come and what they take away from the project, even if they actually found the project in their own backyard.
So what are some of those things that people tend to take away? Clearly, I mean, I've been to the street, and I was really impressed by the visuals, the color, the amazing things that Tyree and the community are doing with discarded objects. What are some of the other things that you guys maybe have heard people from around the world take away as they spend time at the Heidelberg Project space?
It honestly, just like any great history moment, people take away things from, you know, really great reactions. People say that the Heidelberg Project changed their life, and there are always those people that don't like it very much either, but the goal is not to have everyone love it. It's more to evoke some sort of response, and they always walk away thinking, so seems to be successful in that way.
Yeah, definitely, like all great art. I can say, you know, I have the pleasure of overseeing our social networks. So social media gives great insights into that question. And seeing how the project has allowed people in their later years to remember how to play, remember to find beauty in everyday objects, and how to reimagine their own surroundings. So, you know, on one hand, you have people walking away just remembering to enjoy every moment, and then other times you have people walking away inspired to start a movement in their own community. Tyree Guyton showed that one person can have an enormous impact as long as the good intention is there, and that's one of our favorite takeaways that we've heard.
Yeah, it's really about doing what you can with what you have, and that's what Tyree did, and that's a great thing for people to see.
That's so incredible. I remember last year you guys mentioned to me that Tyree and Janine, who also works on the project, went to Germany to talk to a city there that were an auto plant, I believe, was closing. And they were having a talk titled "We Are Not Detroit." But right. Interestingly enough, Tyree turned it around and said, actually, so many places are Detroit. So that's incredible, the international scope of this. But what is the meaning of this for the community that's in? Because, I mean, it's still there's plenty of people who live there. How do they interact with the Heidelberg Project?
That definitely varies. I think that's probably one of the most interesting dynamics of this project. There are some children that, you know, grew up in the early years of the Heidelberg Project that have credited the project for helping them become successful. One of the first things that we kind of learn as an orientation here at the project is the the rate of survival of black males in that community. I'm not sure that the statistic is current now that we have, but it wasn't looking good for young males in that neighborhood. And today we are lucky enough to know that one of the children that grew up in the number house on Heidelberg Street is actually doing very well. He's at the Central Michigan University, Fire Up Chips. Sorry, guys. but he's there on a scholarship. He's also participating in college athletics, and he's studying biomedical technology. So he's doing very, very well. But as Emily mentioned earlier, the project isn't always for everyone. There's always going to be controversy. Some people generally just don't enjoy some of the traffic that's there, which I think we can all kind of understand. As I mentioned, we have people from all over the country visiting every day, all over the world. So it definitely ranges, but I think that the overarching theme here is that most people definitely appreciate Tyree kind of putting himself out there and dedicating so many of his years to bringing color to their neighborhood.
Well, and it sounds like from what you're saying, that's provided a platform, a new kind of security and opportunity for many, maybe not all. And those of us working in rural Africa and looking at uneven development anywhere, really, I mean, anywhere we all grew up, right, from Ohio to Appalachia, we've seen the way that uneven development can cause all kinds of conflicts and both positive and negative effects. But there's a dynamism there that is really amazing. And I know that I think I read somewhere that Tyree and his father as well were involved in some of the early days of the Heidelberg Project. So it's a deep, there are even intergenerational elements to it, it seems to me. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely, yeah. It was his grandfather, actually. His grandfather, Sam Mackey, was the first one to put a paintbrush in his hand.
Wow. Wow.
Yep. And Tyree's always saying, you know, his grandfather told him, you can't stop. You have to keep going. You have to do this. And it's, you know, he originally did it. He did it for the kids in the neighborhood. A lot of those kids were exposed to things that you never want children to be exposed to, let alone adults or anyone else, every day of their lives. And Tyree had them cleaning up the street. He had them painting. He had them building things. And he showed them another way. He showed them opportunity and opened their eyes to that. And that's something that's really priceless.
That's incredible. I would say those words, you can't stop, definitely have given the Heidelberg Project its status as a symbol of Detroit's resiliency. I mean, we can't ignore that on the news last year, we saw that there were some fires. Are you guys, what's going on in terms of rebuilding? Are you guys letting the community drive that, or what's going on with that?
Well, yeah, we've lost 5 house installations to 8 arson fires in 2013. So that doesn't feel good. It's provided us a unique opportunity, though. We've had tremendous support from people all over the world, really calling on that family that we have internationally and right here in Detroit. And we just came off of our Indiegogo campaign, Securing a Legacy. So we raised, $54,000, and we had donors from all over the world. Almost 1,000 people donated to that campaign in 1 month, and that's better than we could have ever.
That's
even
an amazing
for.
Rate. That's an amazing. Well, you know, and it's happening at a time when destruction of Detroit landmarks is very widely in the news through various programs and interventions, right? Not just arson, but planned demolition, about which there's a lot of conflicting feeling, it seems to me, in the broader sort of Detroit landscape, right? So I find it interesting that at the community scale within Heidelberg, this iconic, deeply rooted, longer than all these brand new interventions, you know, Heidelberg stands as all these brand new ideas wash over Detroit.
Right.
And it's also dealing with its own cycle of destruction and renewal. That must be in some way a connection to some of the broader issues now. No?
Absolutely.
So as you guys near your 30th anniversary, which is coming up in 2016, what's your vision for the next couple of years?
Well, as Emily mentioned, the arson fires did present us a very unique opportunity. we're simplifying and we're getting back to our own roots in the community. And instead of, you know, trying to fight so hard for some of those dollars that all the other nonprofits are fighting for, we're really, you know, getting back to our own fundamentals, our own basics, and really looking at how we can best, you know, provide services for our immediate community. The growth of the Heidelberg Project as an organization has been exponential. So we finally have a really great staff in place to actually facilitate some better relationships and distribute better resources, not only just, you know, to our neighbors, but also in working in conjunction with other community partners. So we're very, very excited about this opportunity, and that will be our focus for the next 3 years. You know, how do we not only deploy these new strategies, but how do we measure them, and how do we ensure that we are effective not only in creating great art, but in creating a great community? So it's very exciting for us, and we'll surely keep you all updated on that. But Em, do you want to talk a little bit about rebuilding?
Sure. Yeah. Our primary focus is obviously our neighbors and our community first. So the very first step to that was just about last week. We had a neighbor whose house was destroyed. Well, not destroyed. I'm sorry. Her house was damaged. All of the siding on her house was melted off because she lived next door to where one of the arson fires was. And we had partners come out and help us redo all of the side of her house and fix that for her completely for free, which is awesome. And it was great to see that set up, because the last thing you want is a house without any siding in the middle of the winter. So we're focusing on that, and, you know, we are going to rebuild. Obviously, we're a little bit handicapped by the ongoing investigations surrounding the arson fires and that sort of thing, but we're getting our security plans in place, and some of them have already been implemented. And once it gets warm again, you know, we'll be right back on the cleanups and all of that. But we're starting with one house, and we want to rebuild the House of Soul. It seemed to be, that house represented so many things for so many different people. It was really, I would say, a fan favorite. And Tyree says, you know, not a lot of people see that house as standing for Motown, but it's also those records, that Motown soul, it represents the souls of people all over the world as well. And Tyree's always telling us that you can't heal the land until you heal the souls of the people there. So we want to start with House of Soul. We think that's, you know, the most important place to start. And there's an opportunity for our Indiegogo donors, some of our Indiegogo donors, to actually help with that process. So
wonderful.
We're pretty excited.
Well, the best of luck with that. And we'll definitely have to check in again in the future to hear how everything's going.
We'll do that.
Thank you so much, Katie and Emily.
And thanks for leaving us on a note that has to do with that same interface we've been on all hour between music and the challenges of community building, healthy, sustainable community building, whether it's in Dakar or Detroit. We've got a tune coming up now, a song called Fire, actually, going out as an homage to all those involved in the Heidelberg Project's rebuilding and envisioning efforts. And it's by the Ohio Players. So let's take a listen to that track.
It's
Just a brief sample there of the Ohio Players. If you'd like to check out some of the tunes we heard today, get some of the links to some fantastic scientific papers. Also, we'll put links to Pete Larson's blog. It's peterlarson.com, is that right?
Peter S. Larson.
Peter S. Larson.
Peter Larson's an artist.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we don't confuse.
So the S is for scholar?
The S is for, yeah, super.
Super shredder. Or something. Wow.
We've got those links like we always do on hotinhere.us.
That's correct.
Right? Hotinhere.us.org?
Hotinhere.us. That's
it. Hotinhere.us.
It's
beautiful. That's our new website, folks. It's got MP3s. It's got links to various information that comes up on our show. And today we do have to thank both Katie and Emily calling in from the Heidelberg Project in Detroit for catching us up to date on the efforts that are ongoing there, giving us a little positive energy on the fire front. And also to Pete S. Larson, PhD epidemiologist working in rural Africa on disease prevention, but also keeping it real with metal scenes in Michigan and the U.S. and internationally, looking at African metal and a whole bunch of other stuff none of us knew much about until this hour. Pete, thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you on mic. We want to thank our engineer, Gus.
Keeping it going.
He's just unflappable, man.
Next week, it will be fundraiser, and you can call in and get your very own It's Hot in Here mason jar. It's going to be very exciting.
That's awesome.
So listen often. Let's take it out on a Jay Dilla tune. Bye.
Bye.
Solemn. Bye, everybody.
Bye.